been far from a classic, but Aberdeen have done exactly everything right from this, beautifully inside, Watson, oh the bar, Scanlon, yes, what a marvellous goal to finish this match, they have won, Alec Ferguson is on now in the penalty area, that is it, Aberdeen have definitely won the championship. Can you blame the man for going out of his mind temporarily?
So hello and welcome to the latest By the Minute Aberdeen podcast. Tonight, our guest is a man who's been entwined with Aberdeen Football Club publicly for around about 25, 30 years now, and no doubt privately for a lot longer than that. And we'll speak about that to him a little bit later on in the show. But it's Chris Gavin who's with us tonight. Chris, formerly obviously a board member at AFC, and now one of the key men behind the AFC Heritage Trust. Good evening, Chris. How are you?
Hello there, Richard. I'm great, thanks, and looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, real pleasure to have you on. I've got to say, you've been a name that, as I say, has ever since the first few episodes of The Northern Light came out, that's been on my radar as a sort of prominent Aberdeen fan. So a real treat for me to have you on tonight.
It's a name that's hung around like a bad smell. Persistent.
Well, one thing that was persistent was Aberdeen's attacking play on Saturday. A tremendous, vibrant performance to put away Ross County 4-0. Now, Chris, Ross County in recent past, certainly under Jim McIntyre, once he got them going, they've been usually quite awkward opponents, and we have struggled against them from time to time. So even before they went down to 10 men, you could sense that we were well on top of the match, and it was really good to see that from minute one, because, again, early on this season, a few first halves passed us by, so it's good to see that that transformation.
Yes, indeed. I think we've got a squad of players that really can turn it on when they want to, and it maybe took a little bit of time for them to get gelled together, but it's really beginning to show and pay dividends now. And as happens most summers, I think managers are pretty shrewd in the transfer market.
Well, let's look at each of the goals individually. I mean, the first one, it's all about trademark Johnny Hayes run. And Johnny on Saturday was irrepressible, wasn't he? Even in the 90th minute, still bombing up and down that wing, despite being kicked from pillar to post. And that first goal, I think a real beauty.
It was so fast, you could almost manage to avoid seeing it, really, if you blink.
No, a very fine finish. And the angle as well made it difficult, I think, for Scott Fox. And then a few minutes after that, Johnny Hayes is involved again in another key incident in the match. Tim Chow, the Ross County midfielder, getting a straight red card for a pretty awful lunge over the ball on Johnny Hayes. And Jim McIntyre, to his credit in the post-match interviews, admitted it was a red card and didn't have any complaints. And I don't really think it necessarily would have affected the flow of the game that much, to be honest, Chris. So what do you think?
No, I think you're right. I think... Well, first of all, I have to say, Jim McIntyre, I like his honesty, and he's always like that. And along with that, continue. It's quite refreshing in Scottish football to get that level of honesty from managers. But as to the tackle, well, you know, thankfully we don't see them very often, because that's career-finishing territory that we're going into there.
Yeah, it was a proper lunge and really not the sort of thing we want to see. But and credit to Craig Thompson, who I thought actually refereed things fairly well on Saturday. There's the statement that you won't hear us saying on this podcast very often. But credit to him for taking a few seconds and making the right decision. I think everyone would agree. Another key aspect of Saturday's performance, Chris, was our fullbacks. Really getting forward, really driving forward at every opportunity. And of course, Shea Logan, an assist for the third, but getting that second goal in a real poacher's effort in many ways.
It was, and Shea was always in the right place at the right time on Saturday. He really had the bit between his teeth, and there was almost no part of the pitch that he didn't appear on at some point. I love that backing up the forwards with the overlapping of the fullbacks, and Andy Constantine did very well and all. You know, it's just a shame he didn't get the goal at the late stage of the game when he volleyed it just past.
Yes, that was actually quite a bad miss. Not that it mattered too much in the grand scheme of things, but I was going to speak about Andy as well, because just before Johnny Hayes' first goal, I mean, we win possession back thanks to a tremendous tackle in the middle of the park from Andy. I wouldn't say he himself has necessarily been maligned, but there has been a clamour, perhaps, to have Graham Shinney at left back ahead of him. But I think right now, it's very clear that we need Shinney in the middle of the park more than we need him at left back. It's been something we've discussed and knocked about on this podcast quite a lot, Chris, but your own personal opinion on that?
Yeah, well, I actually quite like Andy at left back, and Shinney is doing a very good job in midfield. He's got a persistence about him, and the way he intervenes in opposition work in the middle of the park is just what we need at the minute. And without Ryan Jack there as well, you know, we've needed that kind of effort. I don't envy the manager the decisions he's going to have to make when Ryan Jack comes back.
Let's talk about some of the decisions made in terms of bringing substitutes on. So we're 3-0 up with half an hour or so to go. Is there a little bit of you that's disappointed that somebody like Craig Story didn't get the opportunity to come on and to gain some more experience at that point?
Well, there's a lot to be said for that. I've always been a champion of our young players coming through the youth system and getting their chance in the first team. So I'd love to see Craig getting more of a game, and I think he's a good enough player to deliver the goods. He certainly demonstrated that against Celtic last season, when he wasn't fazed in the slightest by the opposition that day. And I'm sure he can do it again and again. Just, he needs the game time, but then so do a lot of other players. And it's a terrible dilemma in a way for a manager, albeit a good one as well, to have to try and keep everybody operational and happy. But this is where we benefit from reserve football, I think, and I'm glad it's being discussed again. Youth football is all great, and we need that too, but I think for the more senior players in the under-20s squad and the fringe first team players, we could do with much more reserve activity.
Again, on the youth front, Chris, it came up on our Twitter feed yesterday, a discussion about bringing our own players through, and the last first team regular that really came through from our own youth system. I think it's looking like Ryan Jack, who made his debut back in 2010. Around the same time, Ryan Fraser also made his debut, and he was a regular before moving on. Cammy Smith has obviously played nearly 100 games for the Dons in total, but is obviously away on loan at the moment. But there does, however well the first team is performing, there does need to be that pathway, doesn't there, between youth football and the first team?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always been the success that the club has had has stemmed from that youth development flow, and long may it continue. I think there's far too many clubs do buy in, especially if they're buying in foreign players who are more mercenary than interested in delivering the game that we want to see. But it's so hard because you want the manager to be winning the games every week, and at the same time you want to be introducing these young players. I just never envy the management role, because it's so tough to be the one that's making all these decisions. You know, the strongest sides we had always had guys that come through the ranks.
Well, one of the changes he did make on Saturday was bringing on Jaden Stockley, who got himself a very neat fourth goal. And afterwards, Derek McInnes praised his attitude in training, specifically praised it. I just wonder if that was maybe slightly pointed vis-a-vis maybe some of the other summer transfers. I'm thinking particular Miles Storey, who once again didn't get a look in off the bench. apparently Jaden was insisted upon training with the under-21s during the international break, which is obviously a great attitude. Have you been surprised by how little action Miles Storey has seen so far this season?
Well, not really, because the other players are playing so well, it's going to be hard for anybody to break into the core group. But, it's up to him to keep plugging away and to make his presence felt wherever he gets the chance of a game and show that he's worth being part of it. I think it's time will come anyway, because you can't go through a season with an uninjured squad, as we found out our cost last season. And, we will need these extra bodies before too long.
Obviously, that's now 5 wins on the spin. Fourth time we've managed that, or better, under Derek McInnes, which is tremendous work. and 2 4-goal wins in a row. How different it is from those grumbles that a lot of people had early in the season when we were really struggling to score goals. The team just seemed to have clicked in the last few weeks. Do you think there's any one reason for that? Mr. Maddison obviously has made a very big contribution, but do you think it's just that, or do you think there's been other factors?
No, I think it does take a wee bit of time for new players to be worked in. The manager's trying out a few things as he goes along as well, I guess. And if you drop the odd point here and there early in the season, of course you don't want to, but I mean, it doesn't matter that much because you've always got the chance to pick up the ground later on. The thing is where you're finishing, not where you're starting. And I think sometimes some of our Great Red Army are a little bit too quick off the mark and being a bit negative about that sort of thing.
Well, on Saturday, we have got a Cup semi-final to look forward to. And that's going to be against Morton at Hampden. We've obviously not, in previous shows, we've discussed the implications of that, half-full Hampden on a Saturday lunchtime. But it is what it is. Morton are a name that still are going to send a shiver through Dons fans of a certain age, aren't they, Chris?
Well, thankfully Andy Ritchie isn't playing, so we don't have to worry about that. But they seem to be an up-and-coming side. But if they play their best and we play our best, there's going to be one winner, and we've just got to make sure that we do it.
Well, quite. Derek, in his post-match interview again yesterday, was stressing that he wouldn't be taking Morton lightly, not that you would expect him to. And you do sense that within this playing group, there is maybe a greater degree of professionalism than past squads have potentially had when they've fallen to lower league opposition. That said, obviously, they went out to First Division Hibs last year, so there can't be any complacency at this point. And the other thing, which you know, I hate to point out, but we've lost our last 6 visits to Hampden, and not all to Celtic or Rangers, as were, but to teams like Dundee United and Hibs, teams we probably should be beating.
Don't remind me. you've got to take the lesson from that, and there's no better reminder than the recent past. Of for players to be shown that, reminded that unless you do put in the graft and keep your focus and concentration and get on with it, then you can slip up. And like Duncan Fraser told me that I'm banned from going to Hampden semi-final because he thinks I'm the jinx that's caused all the trouble.
It can't just be you, Chris. It clearly can't just be you, because I would imagine there's quite a few of us out there who have trudged our way back. But that said, Hampden should actually be an advantage for us. It's a pitch in good condition. It's a large pitch. It really should suit the way we want to try and play football, shouldn't it?
Definitely. And it's an opportunity for the players to get used to it, because a lot of them won't have played on there before. And, much as we hate it, the Old Firm players, whoever they turn out to be in the final, have got much more experience of it. So We need to get that, albeit we would have rather played elsewhere, but I changed that venue.
So that's Saturday. Obviously, we'll have a minute-by-minute of that game on our website for you. And here's hoping that there are no slip-ups. And on Saturday afternoon, we're celebrating a return visit to Hampden in November for the League Cup final. So on to our guest this evening, and Chris Gavin. Now, Chris, before we talk about your affiliations with AFC on a semi-official and an official basis, where does your Aberdeen story start? When do you first remember getting introduced to football pataudry?
That would be the mid-1950s. I think it was 1955, as far as I can remember, and there's nobody around to tell me now. But I got taken to a game against Hearts, which I think finished quite a high-scoring game. And we went into the enclosure in front of the main stand, which is sadly no longer with us. And, of course, what was I, 4.5, 5 years old? All I remember really is big men in baggy shorts running about. I don't remember any details of the game at all. But, it's a long haul with my family. My dad and my granddad were both supporters as well. So, we've got to keep the tradition going.
If your first trip there is in the mid-50s, your early memories maybe from games you can remember are not really a vintage period. The early 60s were a bit of a struggle for the Dons, weren't they?
They certainly were, although they always had one or two players that were exceptionally talented, so you know, you could always derive something from the games. But when people think about some of the poor things we've had now, that the 60s can compete with the worst of them, really.
Yes.
Certainly the early 60s.
You talk about some of the players. I mean, who would have been some of your favourites, Chris? Charlie Cook up there, or?
You know who I liked, Billy Little as well, but Charlie Cook was the icing on the cake, wasn't he? He was just such a brilliant player. And later on, turned into a brilliant coach as well.
As we move on, obviously, the big change is Eddie Turnbull coming in, and he really turns that squad over to a substantial degree. And within a couple of years, well, within a year, actually, he's made the cup final, but within a couple of years, he's back at Hampden. And it's a lot of people who have been on this show, the likes of Richard Gordon, the likes of Graham Hunter, have highlighted that 1970 cup final as just being a huge moment in their youth watching AFC. I take it it would have been not dissimilar for you, Chris.
Totally, and that's my favourite Aberdeen period, really, with the Joe Harpers and Davy Robbs and all the others that played at that time, Arthur Graham. You know, it was just a terrific bunch of very talented and tough players. And you needed tough players in the competitions at that time, because it's much more brutal than it is now.
Yes, and the other thing is players just played, didn't they? Players played through knocks, played through aggravations, you know, the sort of thing that people would miss a week or miss 2 weeks for these days. They just played through it, or they got an injection and they kept going, and often to the detriment of their health overall, of course. One good example, speaking of Morton, is Ali McGill, who was Morton manager. He was Morton manager for a long time, and because of injuries sustained during his football career, he had to walk using an aid. So again, just an example of a sort of punishment that their bodies went through, I guess.
It actually amazes me how many players don't seem to have any residual problems, you know, or nothing that they would speak about anyway. I'm sure they're all a bit arthritic and things as they get older, but a lot of them are just pretty fit. I don't know if you saw the former players playing the match against the Red Army out in Bururi a few weeks ago, but I mean, there's Drew Charvey, 69, and he was still strutting his stuff on the park.
Absolutely. And one of the other things you're involved with as well as the trust, Chris, obviously, is the Former Players Association. So I think that's a really positive move by the club, making sure that there's still that connection between the guys who may have only been with us for a couple of seasons, but they still feel part of the Aberdeen family. That's an important move, and clearly something you felt as well before you chose to establish it.
Yes, the reason I started it was because I went to a game in the 80s, I think it was, and saw Davy Robb paying at the gate to get in, you know, and I just thought that was something fundamentally wrong about a player that had served the club so long and done so well, having come in like pardon the expression, an ordinary punter. And so it's been a great thing that the club was very responsive when I suggested that we start an association. And it's got a couple of hundred members, so it's, you know, there's a good link. But players who leave the Tawdry, by and large, will tell you that it was the worst mistake they made, and that you know, the club was not club for them. And they enjoyed it so much they didn't realise how well looked after they were. But I'm now disengaging from the FBs, and Russell Anderson, Stevie Dosh are picking up the reins, getting some fresh ideas.
Okay.
New blood in the system. So that's great. I'm liking it.
Well, that's interesting to hear that they're taking a hands-on role in that, because I know obviously that the game that you spoke about came about really as a result of something that Steve Tosh said, I believe.
Yes, Steve's been keen to have former player teams playing fairly regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Probably so he can push himself around a bit, you know. Get a little bit of a roughing up. But it's great to see, because when you go up against these guys, you know, you think, oh, they're getting past it. But they've still got the touch and the attitude of mind. They had no intention of doing anything but winning by as big a margin as possible.
I'm sure, absolutely sure. It's just that there's that streak that runs through all professional sportsmen, that they just have that will to win, don't they? It's tremendous. Let's speak about the thing which gave you the first prominence within the Aberdeen support, I guess, and that was the Northern Light, which was, I mean, it was part of a movement, Scotland-wide, Britain-wide movement, the fanzine culture of the late 80s. Obviously, I only saw a selection of other Scottish magazines, but it was, the Northern Light, without question, was one of the funniest, one of the sharpest, and it was great at raising causes as well within the support. You were one of the founding editors, Chris, I believe. Now, what was the inspiration? Was it something like The Absolute Game, or...?
Another one of the chaps that founded it, Dave Watt, he was in the middle of the North Sea and had come upon a couple of fanzines on the boat that he was working on. One of them was The Absolute Game, and the other one was When Saturday Comes. And he phoned me up and said, be good to do something like this. And so we just went for it. It was very primitive at the start, but good fun. And the only problem was he would help sell the things. So when we launched the first one, it was at Celtic Park, a league game in December 87, I think it was. Porterfield still managed it anyway. And we didn't know what the ground rules were for things like that were, so we were sort of sneakily hiding them under the jacket, approaching people around the terracing amongst our fellow Dons fans. Happily, some of them didn't think we were just fan pots and bought it and just took off from there.
Yes, it was definitely still Porterfield in charge. I recall some of the early issues, which were none too complimentary about his particular brand of football, that's for sure. I think it's fair to say, and it's unfair for people who weren't aware of the sort of breadth of things which the Northern Light covered, but one of the key causes it took up was towards the end of Alex Smith's reign, and it was very, very keen for a change in management at that point. Very few things where this might be too grand a term, the editorial committee were solidly 100% pointing in the same direction, or...
Well, it was funny because we very rarely agreed on anything. Really, was to let people have their voice and to get what they had to say in print. So we did try and keep a strand of constructiveness going throughout it. Although Charlie Allen didn't think that when he marked our departure from the scene. But we just had such a great mix of people. You know, I mean, Dave Watt was delightfully vicious. And then there was various shades of cutting from there, depending on who was doing what. But quite often, some of the things that went in, to be honest, were just there from desperation to fill the space. It was quite seat of the pants at times.
And yes, a very different kind of setup to how it is now. A lot of photocopying on the sly at work, or absolutely not, Chris?
Sound about that the better. But, The first issue, we had the hand-coloured scarf on the sheet.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing over 1,000 copies coloured by hand of the first issue, and other issues, fortunately, we got into a printer that could do that properly for us. Because, we ended up producing, at the top of it, which was for most issues, about 4,000 copies, which was all we could carry down to Doddery. And it sold out quite often. You'd be practically chased down the street for the last copy in your hand, which was delightful. It was great to have that enthusiasm from fans. You know, I think it was such a good time for fanzines in general that there was an outlet that stood up for the supporters first and foremost. And, it made the press sit up and take notice. And unfortunately, the outcome from that was that they actually started pitching a lot of our ideas.
Yes. And in some cases, some of the writers as well. Obviously, one or two of them have moved on. I'm thinking about a man who is now at The Sun and has been for quite a few years, who cut his teeth at the Northern Light. I mean, again, just the quality of contributors, I think, really made it stand out.
Not only written, but artistically as well. We had some very inventive cartoonists and artists. Bob Harper, who's now well known for his rock and roll type paintings that he's producing from his Glasgow Erie And he produced a piece of work called The Bayou Tapestry. I don't know if you came up on that one.
Yes. Cut across many episodes, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to see that in print again. There was Gordon Reid doing his foul-mouthed efforts, and Gio Alzabidi was very cutting with his artwork and jokes. And there were others. It was quite I can almost hardly remember all the names now. There's so many people from time to time. Ali Ross probably nearly got shut down with some of the stuff, but it seems to be all right when he does it himself. And of course, Michael Grant started off writing with us as well.
Yes, we've mentioned that to him when he's been on here, so and still very proud of the fact he is too.
Now, yeah, well, quite rightly.
Quite rightly, absolutely. Just a word about when it ended, because certainly from the outside it seemed quite abrupt. Was it just a case of exhaustion or?
Not really. No, it was, but, I'm afraid it was my fault. I suggested that we'd gone about as far as we could with it. And so everybody kind of agreed, maybe slightly reluctantly, but called a halt to it. And I think it's probably most fondly remembered for the 20-odd issues that we did than it would be if we'd gone on for hundreds.
But of course, you're a man who obviously couldn't keep quiet, Chris, because a few months later, you're back and you're the editor of the Red Final.
Yes, well, that was kind of an accident as well, because it was going to be a one-off for the opening of the Richard Donald stand.
Yes.
Or the Dick End, as we like to call it. But it seemed to go so well that we thought we'd do a few more. And we were lucky enough to find out a different group of people to do it. So that freshened things up anyway. And it was more aimed at having a lot of fun rather than being quite so hard-hitting, perhaps. And, of course, the Paper Tiger was going in parallel. And it was definitely much more hard to think than we were, but enjoyable nonetheless.
Yes, there was quite a clear schism between the two of you from an ideological point of view there. But yes, both very, very enjoyable in your own way. As we moved into the beginning of the turn of a century, the club was struggling more and more on the pitch, and indeed off the pitch as well. And the vehicles for change, I think they moved from informal ones such as the Red Final to more formal ones such as the Shareholders Association, which you were obviously a key part of, and were agitating for change within Pittodrie. 2004, Willie Miller obviously is brought back again as Director of Football, position on the board. Around about that time, Chris, you were invited in as a fan spokesman onto the board of Pittodrie as well.
That was two years ahead of Willie.
Sorry.
This business of being supporters' representative was a very, very thorny one, because how can you represent many thousands of different people, different opinions? I'm not a politician. But that was the basis on which the club wanted somebody in. And, it was still the shareholders. I think it was still the Shareholders Association at that point. We went through a few iterations of that organisation, but they talked me into doing it. I didn't really want to do it in the first place, but nobody else was prepared to do it, so on I went, and struck up a very good relationship with Stuart Milne right away, and I found him pretty responsive and willing to listen, and so I thought that it went along all right. Keith Wyness was Keith Wyness. There was some funny games along the way with Keith, but he was, he had his heart on his sleeve as well for the club. And I think we all did, really. Everybody in there trying to make it better was important.
Did you feel you had to curb your behaviour, or did not? Curb necessarily, but change your behaviour because you had a club tie on watching the games, or?
I didn't usually have a club tie on watching the games because I was usually still on the terracing, but what I did have to take seriously was the fact that as a non-executive director of a PLC, I had responsibilities to the club first and foremost. So I had to try and marry that up with being a supporters rep.
It seems that your frustrations are more with the vagueness of that role as opposed to any particular personality clashes or issues you might have had with necessarily getting things done there. Do you think it's a role that could actually work within football? Do you think it... Now we obviously have... A lot of clubs have supporters, liaison officers who are meant to be the link between the club and the support. Do you think that's a more appropriate way of doing it? Or
I think it probably is. You know, I think there's more potential there for good things to come out of it. Because the liaison officer is a step away from the boardroom, but he's got access to it. So, you know, he doesn't have the same responsibilities to the club itself as a director does. I think the list of requirements that you is it UEFA or FIFA, whoever it is that laid that down, maybe don't really see the structure of most football clubs. They're just doing it in terms of the biggest clubs, the things they're demanding, and the time that they want someone to give to that kind of role. I think, liaison officer's the way to go.
Well, the reason we actually asked Chris on, and we didn't know we were necessarily going to get Chris himself on, but we wanted to speak to somebody on behalf of the Aberdeen Heritage Trust. Now, the Heritage Trust is obviously responsible for the maintenance, the collection, the preservation of the materials surrounding the club and its hugely proud history. Now, most of our initial interactions with the Heritage Trust will be through their magnificent, absolutely magnificent website and statistics on there. There's barely a day goes past when I'm not using that, Chris. Let's put on record just what a tremendous labour of love that must have been. And it still is, because it's still so much to do, as you're fond of pointing out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no end to it, really. And the more you dig, the more you want to find out about things that you didn't know. And similarly, looking after the collection, you know, we don't know what's out there that we don't have. So there's a constant quest for information and for artefacts going on, and also for money, because we're just a small registered charity, and the income isn't very high, but we're doing our best on what we've got. But we're now facing the challenge of the new stadium, which is looking much more likely than previous iterations of that. And we would be hoping to create a museum in that setup. The plan at the moment is that the club would give us the space, which would be a serviced space, but we'll have to fit it out and look after it. And I think it's a great thing that fans can do the looking after of that part of it, because I think fans are the real custodians of club's heritage. You know, the club's got to look after business, and so heritage matters are a bit of a distraction for the main body of the club. But I think as fans we can do this, and we're just going to need to tap into everybody the resource to get help from wherever we can to do it. I think it's going to probably cost us something we don't know exactly yet, but we're reckoning we'll need several hundred thousand to set up.
Well, that's obviously quite a substantial outlay, but in terms of the day-to-day fundraising, the big event on the horizon coming up is the Big Red Quiz. Can you tell us a bit more about that, Chris?
Yeah, well, it's quite an established thing on the supporter scene now, I would hope, and I'm looking forward to a trust team beating the Buy Them In team. This time out. One of our trustees works away at Bob Bain. He works away at setting it up and organising questions. So I have no idea what they're going to be, in case you were going to try and tap me for that information. I think it'll be a good night again. The last one was very good. It was just a bit unfortunate we had to change the date because of the TV companies switching our match against Partick to the Friday night. because that meant that some of the guys that were going to take part are going down to the game come with me, and they've decided not to participate in our place. If anybody else is listening to your feature, we'd like to slam a team out, but we'd like to welcome them.
No, absolutely, and you can find details of who to contact and how to submit your teams on the Heritage Trust website in the news section. And yeah, the more the merrier. Even if you know very, very little about the Dons' history, it's still a great night. It certainly was last time out, and all the money raised is obviously going to a good cause, to the future of the Heritage Trust. And as Chris speaks about the potentially down the line, the creation of the Heritage Museum. You've obviously been doing this for a number of years, Chris. I know there's a number of other people involved as well as yourself, but of all the artefacts and pieces that you've turned up, what would be your favourite piece?
Well, I guess the 1907 Aberdeenshire Cup poster, when our reserves played Bucky Thistle, is a pretty crowning piece. But there's lots of good things. You know, the boots of George McNichol that turned up out of the blue a few years back, and they were the boots that he wore when he scored the two goals against Brenton in the qualifying cup final. There's masses of things. It's almost unfair to pick one thing out from another. But I must tell you that as a taster for the Big Red Quiz, we're going to unveil another discovery at the quiz.
Excellent.
Just to let people see the sort of thing that they're helping us to get hold of. I'm not going to say any more than that.
No, that's very enticing. Another reason for people to turn up, absolutely. Yeah. As far as the history goes, obviously we did lose a lot of materials back in 1971 when the main stand fire hit. A lot of stuff is just irreplaceable, I guess. A lot of the statistics and stuff can be recreated, but a lot of stuff will never ever get back. And how much of a gap has it left?
Well, like I said earlier, we don't know what we don't know. Unfortunately, that wasn't the only time we lost stuff, because under Richard Donald's stand was being built, a certain individual at Dudley had a load of stuff chucked out in skips, which some of which was rescued by people like the cleaners and kit men. There's things circulating around Aberdeen that we don't know about, that we'd love to know about, and if people have anything that they think is really relevant to the club's proud past, then they should get in touch and let us know about it, even if they're not prepared to put it into the collection. At least let us know so we can keep a record about it and maybe one day.
And that is the other thing, I guess. Yeah, there will be sort of people whose relatives in the past maybe played for Aberdeen or had some role with the club, and maybe up in the loft, maybe handed down from generation to generation, they have something and they're not entirely sure what it is, but if they bring it into the Heritage Trust, then you can help them try and understand exactly what it is. And maybe one day down the line that too could be in the new museum at the new stadium.
It's that's how we came by the Aberdeenshire FA cap that was worn by Alex Sheach way back in the 1890s. So he was the first player to score a goal on the Dodgy. And his family, there's several branches of his family know about them and are looking into them, and they've come to us and spoken about them. We've managed to fill in quite a few blanks about it, and you'd be surprised how often we hear from people whose connection goes back 100 years or more. Tom Strang was a centre-half captain in the early 1900s, and his son, who was must have been what the age gap was, but somehow his son turned up to see us about 8 years ago, and was able to fill in some background about what happened to his father. We're always trying to find out about players when they leave the Dodgy, perhaps. They obviously have lives beyond football, and it'd be nice to be able to flesh it out on the website and then people doing family history research and so forth come on there and get good hard info.
No, of course, of course. And I think the thing I'm most impressed of on the website at the moment is the detail from the really early days of the club. And in fact, the days before the club was actually formed in 1903. It's an incredible level. It must have taken you and the other Trust members hours and hours and hours in Aberdeen Library to come up with some of this information. As it happens, I was just on the page for the game we spoke about earlier, the qualifying cup win against Renton the other day, and there's a brilliant piece reproduced there from one of the now defunct Aberdeen papers, and it's just a fantastic read just to go in and have that level of detail of a game from a competition is no longer contested actually since the last couple of years. It's there for you. You're just at a click of a mouse button. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I sometimes wonder when you type in some of these match reports, especially in league games and minor matches, anybody ever will read them, but at least they're there. And if somebody wants to do research and take the story in other directions in the future, they'll have the base material for it. By the way, I have to give Fraser Klein a lot of credit for the pre-1903 stuff, because you've probably seen his book, The Aberdeen Men Can't Play Football.
Mm-hmm.
He beat me to the punch with that. I think he did a better job than I ever could have done. And that, because he was doing that, it let me concentrate more on the match reports and such like, trying to find the lineups of the teams.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the good thing about this heritage movement, that lots of people can chip in different ways.
Well, of course, I mean, if there are many different ways to support the Trust, it can be with funds, or it can, if you are interested in this topic, I'm sure if you were to get in touch with the Trust, and you can help out in many different ways. So that's the AFC Heritage Trust. Obviously, their website, we'll publicise it on our Twitter feed, but I'm sure you've all used it and are all aware of it in some capacity or other, and that's the sort of main public face of the Trust, who do so much great work behind the scenes. And their quiz night, great fundraising evening on the Saturday the 5th of November. As I say, if you go to the website, you'll find some more details there. Teams of up to four, it's a great night out, even if your quizzing abilities aren't necessarily up to scratch. I'm sure you'll have a great time, and you know you'll be supporting a great club close to the Dons. Just remains for me to thank Chris for his time this evening. It's been a great chat. Thank you very much, Chris.
My pleasure.
And here's hoping that there are no slip-ups on Saturday, and that the Dons see off Morton for the seventh time in a row and make it back to the League Cup final at Hampden in November. Good night.